recognized it too. She heard his sudden gasp and then a hasty murmur. He was saying the Hail Mary in Gaelic as fast as he could.
"Take these to the barracoon,"
Bonnet said to the seaman, pushing Josh in his direction and waving at the Fulani.
"Then go back to the ship. Tell Mr. Orden we sail for England in 4 days' time. He'll see to the rest of the provisioning. Come for me Saturday, an hour before high tide."
"Josh," she called after him, and he looked back, eyes white with fear. But the seaman hustled him along and Bonnet dragged her in the other direction, up the path toward the house.
"Wait, where's he taking him? What are you going to do with him?"
She dug her feet into the mud and grabbed hold of a mangrove, refusing to move.
"Sell him? What else?"
Bonnet was matter-of-fact about that, and also about her refusal to move.
"Come along, darling. You know I can make you, and you know you won't like it if I do."
He reached out, flipped back the edge of her cloak, and pinched her nipple hard in illustration. Burning with anger, she snatched the cloak back and wrapped it tight around her, as though that might soothe the pain. He had already turned and was making his way up the path, quite certain that she would follow. To her everlasting shame, she did. The door was opened by a black man nearly as tall as Bonnet himself and even wider through the chest and shoulder. A thick vertical scar between his eyes ran nearly from his hairline to the bridge of his nose, but it had the clean look of a deliberate tribal scar, not the result of accident.
"Emmanuel, me man,"
Bonnet greeted the man cheerfully and pushed Brianna ahead of him into the house.
"Look what the cat dragged in, will you?"
The black man looked her up and down with an expression of doubt.
"She damn tall," he said,
in a voice that held an African lilt. He took her by the shoulder and turned her round, running a hand down her back and cupping her buttocks briefly through the cloak.
"Nice fat arse, though," he admitted grudgingly. "Isn't it, though? Well, be seen to her, then come and tell me how it is here. The hold's near full. Oh, and I've picked up five more blacks. The men can go to Captain Jackson. But the women, now those are something special."
He winked at Emmanuel.
"Twins."
The black man's face went rigid.
"Twins," he said, in a tone of horror. "You bring them in the house?"
"I will,"
Bonnet said firmly. "Fulani, and gorgeous things they are too. No English, no training, but they'll go for fancies, sure. Speaking of which, have we heard from Signor Ricasoli?"
Emmanuel nodded, though his brow was furrowed. The scar pulled the frown lines into a deep V.
"He be here on Thursday. Monsieur Hoovener comes then too. Mr. Howard be here tomorrow, though."
"Splendid.
I'm wanting me breakfast now, and I imagine you're hungry as well, aren't you, darling?"
he asked, turning to Brianna. She nodded, torn between fear, outrage, and morning sickness. She had to eat something, and fast.
"Fine, then. Take her somewhere."
He flipped a hand toward the ceiling, indicating rooms upstairs.
"And feed her. I'll eat in me office. Come and find me there."
Without acknowledgement of the order, Emmanuel clamped a hand like a vice on the back of her neck and shoved her toward the stairs. The butler, if one could describe something like Emmanuel with such a domestic term, pushed her into a small room and shut the door behind her. It was furnished, but sparsely. A bed frame with a bare mattress, one woolen blanket, and a chamber pot. She made use of the latter object with relief, then made a rapid reconnaissance of the room itself. There was only one window, a small one, set with metal bars. There was no glass, only inside shutters, and the breath of sea and scrub forest filled the room, vying with dust and the stale smell of the stained mattress. Emmanuel might be a factotum, but he wasn't much of a housekeeper, she thought, trying to keep her spirits up. A familiar sound came to her, and she craned her neck to see. Not much was visible from the window, only the white crushed shells and sandy mud that surrounded the house, and the tops of stunted pines. If she pressed her face to the side of the window, though, she could see a small slice of a distant beach, with the white breakers rolling in. As she watched, three horses galloped across it, vanishing out of her view. But with the wind-borne sound of neighing, then came five more, and then another group of seven or eight. Wild horses, the descendants of Spanish ponies left here a century ago. The sight of them charmed her, and she watched for a long time, hoping they would come back, but they didn't. Only a flight of pelicans passed by, and a few gulls diving for fish. The sight of the horses had made her feel less alone for a few moments, but no less empty. She had been in the room for half an hour at least, and there were no sounds of footsteps in the hall outside bringing food. Cautiously, she tried the door, and was surprised to find it unlocked. There were sounds downstairs. Someone was here. And the warm, grainy aromas of porridge and baking bread were faint in the air. Swallowing to keep her stomach down, she moved soft-footed through the house and down the stairs. There were male voices in a room at the front of the house, Bonnet and Emmanuel. The sound of them made her diaphragm tighten, but the door was closed, and she tiptoed past. The kitchen was a cook shack, a separate small building outside, connected to the house by a short breezeway and surrounded by a fenced yard that also enclosed the back of the house. She gave the fence, very tall and spiked, a glance, but first things first, she had to have food. There was someone in the kitchen. She could hear the movement of pots and a woman's voice muttering something. The smell of food was strong enough to lean against. She pushed open the door and went in, pausing to let the cook see her. Then she saw the cook. She was so battered by circumstances at this point that she only blinked, certain she was seeing things. "Phaedra?" she said uncertainly. The girl swung around, wide-eyed and open-mouthed with shock. "Oh, sweet Jesus!" She glanced wildly behind Brianna, then, seeing that she was alone, grabbed Brianna's arm and pulled her out into the yard. "What you doing here?" she demanded, sounding fierce. "How do you come to be here?" "Stephen Bonnet," Brianna said briefly. "How on earth did you... did he kidnap you? From River Run?" She couldn't think how or why, but everything from the moment she had learned she was pregnant had had the surreal feel of hallucination. And how much of this was due to pregnancy alone, she had no real idea. Phaedra was shaking her head, though. "No, miss. That Bonnet, he got me a month ago, from a man named Butler," she added, mouth twisting in an expression that made clear her loathing of Butler. The name seemed vaguely familiar to Brianna. She thought it was the name of a smuggler. She'd never met him, but had heard the name now and then. He wasn't the smuggler who provided her aunt with tea and other contraband luxuries, though. She had met that man, a disconcertingly effete and dainty gentleman named Wilbraham Jones. "I don't understand, but wait, is there anything to eat?" she asked, the floor of her stomach dropping suddenly. "Oh, surely. You wait here." Phaedra vanished back into the kitchen, light-footed, and was back in an instant with half a loaf of bread and a crock of butter. "Thank you." She grabbed the bread and ate some hastily, not bothering to butter it, then put down her head between her knees and breathed for a few minutes until the nausea subsided. "Sorry," she said, raising her head at last. "I'm pregnant." Phaedra nodded, plainly unsurprised. "Who by?" she asked. "My husband," Brianna answered. She'd spoken tartly, but then realized with a small lurch of her unsettled innards that it could so easily be otherwise. Phaedra had been gone from River Run for months. God only knew what had happened to her in that span of time.
"He's not had you long, then?"
Phaedra glanced at the house.
"No.
You said a month. Have you tried to get away?"
"Once."
The girl's mouth twisted again.
"You see that man, Emmanuel?"
Brianna nodded.
"He and Ebo track a haunt through a cypress swamp and make it sorry when he catch it."
She wrapped her arms around herself, though the day was warm. The yard was fenced with 8-foot pointed pine stakes laced with rope.
She might get over them with a foot up from Fed. But then she saw the shadow of a man pass by on the other side, a gun across his shoulder. She would have guessed as much had she been capable of organized thought. This was Bonnet's hideaway, and judging from the piles of boxes, bundles and casks stacked haphazardly in the yard, it was also where he kept valuable cargo before selling it. Naturally it would be guarded. A faint breeze wafted through the pickets of the fence, carrying the same vile stench she had smelled when they came ashore. She took another quick bite of bread, forcing it down as ballast for her queasy stomach. Fed's nostrils flared, then pinched at the reek. "Be a slave ship, anchored past the breakers," she said very quietly and swallowed. "Captain come in yesterday, see if Mr. Bonnet have something for him, but he ain't back yet. Captain Jackson say he'll come again tomorrow." Brianna could feel Fedra's fear like a pale yellow miasma wavering over her skin, and took another bite of bread. He wouldn't sell you to this Jackson. She wouldn't put anything at all past Bonnet. But she did by now understand things about slavery. Fedra was a prime item, light-skinned, young, and pretty, and trained as a body servant. Bonnet could get a very good price for her almost anywhere, and from what little she knew of slavery, they dealt in raw slaves from Africa. Fed shook her head, her lips gone pale. "I don't think so. He say I'm what he call a fancy. That's why he's kept me so long. He got some men, he know, come up from the Indies this week. Planters." She swallowed again, looking ill. "They buy pretty women." The bread Brianna had eaten melted suddenly into a soggy, slimy mass in her stomach, and with a certain feeling of fatality, she got up and took a few steps away before throwing up over a bale of raw cotton. Stephen Bonnet's voice echoed in her head, cheerfully jovial. "I bother taking you all the way to London, where you'd be of no particular use to anyone. Besides, it rains quite a bit in London. I'm sure you wouldn't like it." "They buy pretty women," she whispered, leaning against the palisades, waiting for the sense of clamminess to fade. "But white women?" "Why not?" said the coldly logical part of her brain. "Women are property, black or white. If you can be owned, you can be sold." She herself had owned Lizzie, for a time. She wiped her sleeve over her mouth and went back to Fedra, who was sitting on a roll of copper, her fine-boned face thin and drawn with worry. "Josh. He took Josh, too. When we came ashore, he told them to take Josh to the barracoon." "Joshua?" Fedra sat up straight, eyes huge. "Joshua? Miss Jo's groom? He's here?" "Yes. Where's the barracoon, do you know?" Fedra had hopped to her feet and was striding to and fro, agitated. "I ain't know him for sure. I cook up food for the slaves there, but be one of the seamen takes it. Can't be far from the house, though." "Is it a big one?" Fedra shook her head emphatically at that. "No'm. Mr. Bonnet, he ain't really in the slaving business. He pick up a few here and there, and then he got his fancies." She grimaced at that. "But can't be more'n a dozen here, amount of food they eat. 3 girls in the house, 5 counting they Fulani, he say he's bringing." Feeling better, Brianna began to cast about the yard, searching for anything that might be of use. It was a hodgepodge of valuable things. Everything from bolts of Chinese silk wrapped in linen and oiled cloth, and crates of porcelain dishes, to rolls of copper, casks of brandy, bottles of wine packed in straw, and chests of tea. She opened one of these, breathing in the soft perfume of the leaves and finding it wonderfully soothing to her internal distress. She'd give almost anything for a hot cup of tea just now. Even more interesting, though, were a number of small barrels, thick-walled and tightly sealed, containing gunpowder. "If only I had a few matches," she muttered to herself, looking at them longingly. "Or even a striker.
But fire was fire, and there was certainly one in the kitchen. She looked at the house carefully, thinking exactly where to place the barrels. But she couldn't blow the place up, not with the other slaves inside, and not without knowing what she'd do next. The sound of the door opening galvanized her. By the time Emmanuel looked out, she had jumped away from the gunpowder and was examining an enormous box enclosing a grandfather clock, the gilded face decorated with three animated sailing ships on a sea of silver, peeping out behind the protective laths nailed over it.
"You, girl,"
he said to Brianna, and jerked his chin.
"You, come wash yourself."
He gave Fred a hard look. Brianna saw that she wouldn't meet his eyes, but hastily began to pick up sticks of kindling from the ground. The hand clamped hard on her neck again, and she was marched ignominiously back into the house. This time, Emmanuel did lock the door. He brought her a basin and ewer, a towel and a clean shift. Much, much later, he came back, bringing a tray of food, but he ignored all questions and locked the door again upon leaving. She pulled the bed over to the window and knelt on it, elbows wedged between the bars. There was nothing to do but think, and that was something she would as soon put off a little longer. She watched the forest and the distant beach, the shadows of the scrub pines creeping over the sand, the oldest of sundials, marking the snail-like progress of the hours. After a long time, her knees grew numb and her elbows hurt, and she spread the cloak over the nasty mattress, trying not to consider the various stains on it, nor the smell. Lying on her side, she watched the sky through the window, the infinitesimal changes of the light from one moment to the next, and considered in detail the specific pigments and the exact brushstroke she would use to paint it. Then she got up and began pacing to and fro, counting her steps, estimating distance. The room was about 8 feet by 10, 5,280 feet in a mile, 528 laps. She really hoped Bonnet's office was underneath her. Nothing, though, was enough, and even as the room darkened and she reached 2 miles, she found Roger in her mind, where he had been all along, unacknowledged. She sank down on the bed, hot from the exercise, and watched the last of the flaming colour fade from the sky. Had he been ordained, as he wanted so much? He'd been worried about the question of predestination, not sure that he could take the holy orders he desired if he were not able to subscribe wholeheartedly to that notion. Well, she called it a notion. To Presbyterians, it was dogma. She smiled wryly, thinking of Hiram Crombie. Ian had told her about Crombie earnestly attempting to explain the doctrine of predestination to the Cherokee. Most of them had listened politely, then ignored him. Bird's wife, Pen Steeman, though, had been interested by the argument and followed Crombie about during the day, playfully pushing him, then crying out, "Did your God know I would do that? How could he know that? I didn't know I would do that." Or in a more thoughtful mood, trying to get him to explain how the idea of predestination might work in terms of gambling. Like most of the Indians, Pen Steeman would bet on almost anything. She thought Pen Steeman had probably had a lot to do with the shortness of Crombie's initial visit to the Indians. She had to give him credit, though. He'd gone back, and back again. He believed in what he was doing. As did Roger. "Damn," she thought wearily. There he was again, those soft, moss-green eyes of his dark with thought, running a finger slowly down the bridge of his nose. "Does it really matter?" she'd said at last, tiring of the discussion of predestination, and privately pleased that Catholics weren't required to believe any such thing, and were content to let God work in mysterious ways. "Doesn't it matter more that you can help people? That you can offer comfort?" They'd been in bed, the candle extinguished, talking by the glow of the hearth. She could feel the shift of his body as he moved, his hand playing with a strand of her hair as he considered. I don't know, he'd said at last. He'd smiled a bit then, looking up at her.
Do you not think any time-traveller must be a bit of a theologian, though?
She'd taken a deep, martyred breath, and he'd laughed then, and let it go, kissing her instead, and descending to far earthier matters. He'd been right, though. No one who had travelled through the stones could help asking it. Why me? And who would answer that question, if not God? Why me? And the ones who didn't make it, why them? She felt a small chill thinking of those. The anonymous bodies listed in Gillis Duncan's notebook. Donna's companions dead on arrival. And speaking of Gillis Duncan, the thought came to her suddenly. The witch had died here, out of her own time. Putting metaphysics aside, and looking at the matter purely in terms of science, and it must have a scientific basis, she argued stubbornly, it wasn't magic, no matter what Gillis Duncan had thought. The laws of thermodynamics held that neither mass nor energy could be created nor destroyed. Only changed. Changed how, though? Did movement through time constitute change? A mosquito whined past her ear, and she flapped her hand to drive it away. You could go both ways. They knew that for a fact. The obvious implication, which neither Roger nor her mother had mentioned, so perhaps they hadn't seen it, was that one could go into the future from a starting point, rather than only into the past and back. So, perhaps, if someone travelled to the past and died there, as Gillis Duncan and Ottertooth had both demonstrably done, perhaps that must be balanced by someone travelling to the future and dying there. She closed her eyes, unable or unwilling to follow that train of thought any further. Far in the distance, she heard the sound of the surf pounding on the sand, and thought of the slave ship. Then she realized that the smell of it was here, and rising suddenly, went to the window. She could just see the far end of the path that led to the house. As she watched, a big man in a dark blue coat and hat stumped rapidly out of the trees, followed by two others, shabbily dressed. Sailors, she thought, seeing the roll of their gait. This must be Captain Jackson, then, come to conduct his business with Bonnet. Oh, Josh, she said out loud, and had to sit down on the bed, a wave of faintness washing over her. Who had it been? One of the St. Teresas? Teresa of Avila? Who'd said in exasperation to God, Well, if this is how you treat your friends, no wonder you have so few of them.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
A Breath of Snow and Ashes by Diana Gabaldon.
She had fallen asleep, thinking of Roger. She waked in the morning, thinking of the baby. For once, the nausea and the odd sense of dislocation were absent. All she felt was a deep peace and a sense of curiosity. Are you there? She thought, hands across her womb. Nothing so definite as an answer, but knowledge was there, as sure as the beating of her own heart. Good, she thought, and fell asleep again. Noises from below awakened her some time later. She sat up suddenly, hearing loud voices raised, then swayed, feeling faint, and lay down again. The nausea had returned, but if she closed her eyes and kept very still, it lay dormant, like a sleeping snake. The voices continued, rising and falling with the occasional loud thud for punctuation, as though a fist had struck a wall or table. After a few minutes, though, the voices ceased, and she heard nothing further until light footsteps came to her door. The lock rattled, and Phaedra came in with a tray of food. She sat up, trying not to breathe. The smell of anything fried. "What's going on down there?" she asked. Fed pulled a face.
"That Emmanuel. He's not best pleased with they Fulani women. Ibo, they think twins are bad, bad luck. Any woman bear twins, she take them out in the forest, leave them there to die. Emmanuel want to send the Fulani off with Captain Jackson first thing, get them out the house. But Mr. Bonnet, he say he waiting on the gentleman from the Indies. Get a lots better price."
"Gentleman from the Indies? What gentleman?" Phedre lifted her shoulders.
"I ain't knowing. Gentleman he think he sell things to. Sugar planters, I reckon. You eat that. I be back later."
Phedre turned to go, but Brianna suddenly called after her. "Wait! You didn't tell me yesterday. Who took you from River Run?" The girl turned back, looking reluctant.
"Mr. Ulysses."
"Ulysses?" Brianna said, disbelieving. Fed heard the doubt in her voice and gave her a flat, angry look.
"What, you don't believe me?"
"No, no," Brianna hastily assured her. "I do believe you. Only, why?" Fed breathed in deeply through her nose.
"Because I am one damn stupid nigger," she said bitterly. "My mama told me. She say never, ever cross Ulysses. But did I listen?"
"Cross him?" Brianna said warily.
"How did you cross him?"
She gestured to the bed, inviting Phedre to sit down. The girl hesitated for a moment, but then did, smoothing a hand over the white cloth tied round her head, over and over while she searched for words.
"Mr. Duncan," she said at last, and her face softened a little. "He a nice, nice man. You know he never been with a woman? He got kicked by a horse when he young, hurt his balls. Think he can't do nothing that way."
Brianna nodded. She'd heard something of Duncan's trouble from her mother.
"Well," Phedre said with a sigh, "he wrong about that."
She glanced at Brianna to see how she might take this admission.
"He wasn't meaning no harm, and nor was I. It just happened." She shrugged. "But Ulysses, he find it out. He find out every single thing goes on at River Run sooner or later. Maybe one of the girls told him, maybe some other way, but he knew. And he told me that ain't right. I put a stop to it this minute."
"But you didn't," Brianna guessed. Fred shook her head slowly, lips pushed out.
"Told him I'd stop when Mr. Duncan didn't want no more. Not his business. See, I thought Mr. Duncan, he the master. Ain't true, though. Ulysses be the master at River Run."
"So he took you away? Sold you? To stop you sleeping with Duncan?"
"Why would he care?" she wondered. "Was he afraid Jocasta would discover the affair and be hurt?" "No. He sell me because I told him if he don't leave me and Mr. Duncan be, then I tell about him and Miss Joe."
"Him and—" Brianna blinked, not believing what she was hearing. Fred looked at her and gave her a small, ironic smile.
"He share Miss Joe's bed these 20 years and more. Says before old master die, my mama said. Every slave there knows it. Ain't one stupid enough to say so to his face, except me."
Brianna knew she was gaping like a goldfish, but couldn't help it. 100 tiny things she'd seen at River Run, myriad small intimacies between her aunt and the butler, suddenly took on new significance. No wonder her aunt had gone to such lengths to get him back after the death of Lieutenant Wolfe. And no wonder, either, that Ulysses had taken instant action. Phedre might have been believed or not. The mere accusation would have destroyed him. Phedre sighed and rubbed a hand over her face.
"He ain't waste no time. That very night he and Mr. Jones come and take me from my bed, wrap me up tight in a blanket, and carry me away in a wagon. Mr. Jones, he say he ain't no slaver, but he do it as a favour for Mr. Ulysses. So he don't keep me. He take me down river, though, sell me in Wilmington to a man what owns an ordinary. That's not too bad. But then, a couple of months later, Mr. Jones comes and takes me back. Wilmington's not far enough away to suit Ulysses. So he give me to Mr. Butler, and Mr. Butler, he take me to Edenton. She looked down, pleating the quilt between long, graceful fingers. Her lips were tight, and her face slightly flushed. Brianna forbore to ask what she had done for Butler in Edenton, thinking that she had likely been employed in a brothel. And Stephen Bonnet found you there? She hazarded. Fed nodded, not looking up. Won me in a card game, she said succinctly. She stood up. I gotta go. I had me enough of crossing black men. Ain't risking no more beatings from that Emmanuel. Brianna was beginning to emerge from the shock of hearing about Ulysses and her aunt. A sudden thought occurred to her, and she jumped out of bed, hurrying to catch Phaedra before she reached the door. Wait! Wait! Just one more thing. Do the slaves at River Run know anything about the gold? What? In old master's tomb? Surely. Phaedra's face expressed a cynical surprise that there could be any doubt about it. Ain't nobody touch it, though. Everybody know there a curse on it. Do you know anything about its disappearing? Phaedra's face went blank. Disappearing? Oh, wait. No, you wouldn't know. You left long before it disappeared. I just wondered, you know, whether maybe Ulysses had something to do with that. Phaedra shook her head. I don't know nothing about that. But I ain't put one thing past Ulysses, curse or no. There was a sound of heavy footsteps on the stair, and she paled. Without a word or gesture of farewell, she slipped out the door and closed it. Brianna heard the frantic fumbling of the key on the other side, and then the click of the closing lock. Emmanuel, silent as a lizard, brought her a dress in the afternoon. It was too short by a good bit, and too tight in the bosom, but a heavy blue watered silk, and well made. It had plainly been worn before. There were sweat stains on it, and it smelled of fear, she thought, repressing a shudder as she struggled into it. She was sweating herself as Emmanuel led her downstairs, though a pleasant breeze swept through the open windows, stirring the curtains. The house was very simple for the most part, with bare wooden floors, and little more than stools and bed frames by way of furniture. The room downstairs to which Emmanuel showed her was such a contrast that it might have belonged to a different house entirely. Rich Turkey rugs covered the floor in an overlapping riot of colour, and the furniture, while of several different styles, was all heavy and elaborate, carved wood and silk upholstery. Silver and crystal glittered from every available surface, and a chandelier, much too large for the room, hung with crystal pendants, sprayed the room with tiny rainbows. It was a pirate's idea of a rich man's room, lavish abundance displayed with no sense of style or taste. The rich man seated by the window appeared not to mind his surroundings, though. A thin man in a wig, with a prominent Adam's apple, he looked to be in his 30s, though his skin was lined and yellowed by some tropical disease. He glanced sharply at the door as she entered, then rose to his feet. Bonnet had been entertaining his guest. There were glasses and a decanter on the table, and the smell of brandy was sweet and heavy in the air. Brianna felt her stomach shift queasily, and wondered what they'd do if she were to vomit on the turkey rug. "There you are, darling," Bonnet said, coming to take her by the hand. She pulled it away from him, but he affected not to notice, and instead pushed her toward the thin man, a hand in the small of her back. "Come and make your bob to Mr. Howard, sweetheart." She drew herself to her full height. She was a good 4 inches taller than Mr. Howard, whose eyes widened at sight of her, and glowered down at him. "I'm being held against my will, Mr. Howard. My husband and my father will—" "Ow!"
Bonnet had gripped her wrist and twisted it hard.
"Lovely, is she not?" he said conversationally, as though she hadn't spoken.
"Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. Very tall, though."
Howard walked round her, examining her dubiously.
"And red hair, Mr. Bonnet. I do really prefer blonde."
"Oh, do you indeed, you little pissant?" she snapped in spite of Bonnet's grip on her arm. "Where do you get off preferring things?"
With a wrench, she pulled away from Bonnet and rounded on Howard.
"Now look," she said, trying to sound reasonable. He was blinking at her in a faintly bewildered fashion. "I'm a woman of good, of excellent family, and I've been kidnapped. My father's name is James Fraser, my husband is Roger Mackenzie, and my aunt is Mrs. Hector Cameron of River Run Plantation."
"Is she really of good family?"
Howard addressed this question to Bonnet, appearing to be more interested. Bonnet bowed slightly in affirmation.
"Oh, indeed she is, sir. The finest blood."
"Hmm. And good health, I see."
Howard had resumed his examination, leaning close to peer at her.
"Has she bred before?"
"Aye, sir. A healthy son."
"Good teeth?"
Howard rose on his toes, looking inquisitive, and Bonnet obligingly yanked one arm behind her back to hold her still, then took a handful of her hair and jerked her head back, making her gasp. Howard took her chin in one hand and pried at the corner of her mouth with the other, poking experimentally at her molars.
"Very nice," he said approvingly. "And I will say the skin is very fine, but..."
She jerked her chin out of his grasp and bit down as hard as she could on Howard's thumb, feeling the meat of it shift and tear between her molars with a sudden copper taste of blood. He shrieked and struck at her. She let go and dodged, enough so his hand glanced off her cheek. Bonnet let go and she took two fast steps back and fetched up hard against the wall.
"She's bitten me thumb off, the bitch!"
Eyes watering in agony, Mr. Howard swayed to and fro, cradling his wounded hand against his chest.
Fury flooded his face, and he lunged toward her, free hand drawn back. But Bonnet seized him by the wrist and pulled him aside.
"Now then, sir," he said, "I cannot allow you to damage her, sure. She's not yours yet, is she?"
"I don't care if she's mine or not," Howard cried, face suffused with blood. "I'll beat her to death."
"Oh, no, surely you don't mean that, Mr. Howard,"
Bonnet said, his voice jovially soothing.
"A cruel waste that would be. Leave her to me, will you, then?"
Not waiting for an answer, he pulled Brianna after him, dragging her stumbling across the room and thrust her toward the silent factotum, who had waited motionless by the door through the conversation.
"Take her out, Manny, and teach her her manners, will you? And gag her before you bring her back."
Emmanuel didn't smile, but a faint light seemed to burn in the black depths of his pupilless eyes. His fingers dug between the bones of her wrist, and she gasped with pain, jerking in a vain attempt to free herself. With a single quick movement, the Igbo whirled her round and twisted up her arm behind her back, bending her half forward. Sharp pain shot up her arm as she felt her shoulder tendons begin to part. He pulled harder, and a dark wave passed over her vision. Through it, she heard Bonnet's voice calling out behind them as Emmanuel propelled her through the door.
"Not in the face, mind, Manny. And no permanent marks."
Howard's voice had quite lost its choked note of fury. It was still choked, but with something more like awe.
"My God," he said. "Oh, my God." "A charming sight, is it not?"
Bonnet agreed cordially.
"Charming," Howard echoed. "Oh, the most charming thing I believe I have ever seen. Such a shade. Might I?"
The hunger in his voice was evident, and Brianna felt the vibration of his footstep on the carpet a split second before his hands clamped tight on her buttocks. She screamed behind the gag, but she was bent hard across the table with the edge cutting into her diaphragm, and the sound came out as no more than a grunt. Howard laughed joyfully and let go.
"Oh, look," he said, sounding enchanted. "Look, do you see?
a most perfect print of my hands. So white on the crimson. She is so hot. Oh, it's fading. Let me just... She clenched her legs tight together and stiffened as he fondled her naked privates. But then his touch was gone, and Bonnet had taken his hand off her neck and was pulling his customer away from her.
Ah, no, that's enough, sir. After all, she's not your property. Not yet.
Bonnet's tone was jovial but firm. Howard's response was immediately to offer a sum that made her gasp behind the gag, but Bonnet only laughed.
That's generous, sir, so it is. But 'twouldn't be fair on my other customers, would it, to be taking your offer without letting them make their own? No, sir, I do appreciate it, but I mean to auction this one. I'm afraid you'll needs be waiting on the day.
Howard was disposed to protest, to offer more. He was most urgently in earnest. He protested that he couldn't wait, was ravished by desire, a great deal too warm to abide delay. But Bonnet only demurred, and in a few moments had ushered him out of the room. Brianna heard his voice protesting, dying away as Emmanuel removed him. She had stood up as soon as Bonnet took his hand off her neck, wriggling madly to shake her skirts down. Emmanuel had tied her hands behind her back as well as gagging her. If he hadn't, she would have tried to kill Stephen Bonnet with her bare hands. This thought must have been visible on her face, for Bonnet glanced at her, looked again, and laughed.
"You did amazing well, darling," he said,
and leaning over, negligently pulled the gag down from her mouth. "That man will empty his purse for the chance to get his hands on your ass again."
"You goddamn! You—"
She shook with rage, and with the futility of finding any epithet that came close to being strong enough.
"I will fucking kill you."
He laughed again.
"Oh, no, sweetheart, for a sore ass.
Consider it a repayment, in part, for my left ball." He chucked her under the chin and went toward the table where the tray with the decanters stood.
"You've earned a drink. Brandy or porter?"
She ignored the offer, trying to keep her rage in check. Her cheeks flamed with furious blood, and so did her outraged bottom.
"What do you mean, auction?" she demanded.
"I should think that clear enough, sweetheart. You've heard the word, sure."
Bonnet gave her a glance of mild amusement, and, pouring himself a tot of brandy, drank it off in two swallows.
"Ah!"
He exhaled, blinking, and shook his head.
"Whew! I've two more customers in the market for someone like you, darling. They'll be here tomorrow or next day to be having a look. Then I'll ask for bids, and you'll be off to the Indies by Friday, I expect."
He spoke casually, without the slightest hint of jeering. That, more than anything, made her insides waver. She was a matter of business, a piece of merchandise. To him, and to his goddamned bloody customers, too.
Mr. Howard had made that clear.
It didn't matter what she said. They weren't at all interested in who she was or what she might want. Bonnet was watching her face, his pale green eyes assessing. He was interested, she realized, and her insides curled up into a knot.
"What did you use on her, Manny?" he asked. "A wooden spoon," the manservant said indifferently. "You said no marks."
Bonnet nodded, thoughtful.
"Nothing permanent, I said," he corrected. "We'll leave her as she is for Mr. Riccasoli, I think. But Mr. Hoovener, well, we'll wait and see."
Emmanuel merely nodded, but his eyes rested on Brianna with sudden interest. Her stomach inverted itself neatly, and she vomited, absolutely ruining the fine silk dress. The sound of high-pitched whinnying reached her, wild horses rioting down the beach. If this were a romance novel, she thought grimly, she'd make a rope from the bedclothes, let herself down from the window, find the horse herd, and by exercising her mystical skills with horses, persuade one of them to carry her to safety. As it was, there were no bedclothes, only a ratty mattress made of ticking stuffed with seagrass. And as for getting within a mile of wild horses, she would have given a lot for Gideon, and felt tears prickle at thought of him. "Oh, now, you are losing your mind," she said aloud, wiping her eyes. "Crying over a horse? Especially that horse." That was so much better than thinking of Roger, though. Or Jem. No, she absolutely could not think about Jemmy, nor the possibility of his growing up without her, without knowing why she had abandoned him. Or the new one. And what life might be like for the child of a slave. But she was thinking of them, and the thought was enough to overcome her momentary despair. All right, then. She was getting out of here, preferably before Mr. Ricasoli and Mr. Hoovener, whoever they were, turned up. For the thousandth time she moved restlessly around the room, forcing herself to move slowly, look at what was there. Damn little, and what there was, stoutly built, was the discouraging answer. She'd been given food, water for washing, a linen towel, and a hairbrush with which to tidy herself. She picked it up, assessing its potential as a weapon, then threw it down again. The chimney stack rose through this room, but there was no open half. She thumped the bricks experimentally, and pried at the mortar with the end of the spoon they'd given her to eat with. She found one place where the mortar was cracked enough to pry, but a quarter of an hour's trying managed to dislodge only a few inches of mortar. The brick itself stayed firmly in place. Given a month or so, that might be worth a try, though the chances of someone her size managing to squeeze up an 18th-century flue. It was getting up to rain. She heard the excited rattle of the palmetto leaves as the wind came through, sharp with the smell of rain. It wasn't quite sunset, but the clouds had darkened, so the room seemed dim. She had no candle. No one expected her to read or sew. She threw her weight against the bars of the window for the dozenth time, and for the dozenth time found them solidly set and unyielding. Again, in a month, she might contrive to sharpen the spoon's end by grinding it against the chimney bricks, then use it as a chisel to chip away enough of the frame to dislodge one or two bars. But she didn't have a month. They'd taken away the fouled dress and left her in shift and stays. Well, that was something. She pulled off the stays and, by picking at the ends of the stitching, extracted the busk, a flat 12-inch strip of ivory that ran from sternum to navel. A better weapon than a hairbrush, she thought. She took it over to the chimney and began to rasp the end against the brick, sharpening its point. Could she stab someone with it? Oh, yes, she thought fiercely. And please let it be Emmanuel. Chapter 108.
Damn tall.
Roger waited in the cover of the thick bayberry bushes near the shore. A little way beyond, Ian and Jamie lay likewise in wait. The second ship had arrived in the morning, coming to anchor a fastidious distance beyond the slaver. Sloshing nets over the side of Rourke's ship in the guise of fishermen, they'd been able to watch as first the captain of the slaver went ashore, and then, an hour later, a boat from the second ship was lowered and rowed ashore with two men and a small chest in it. "A gentleman," Claire had reported, scanning them through the telescope. "Wig, nicely dressed. The other man's a servant of some kind. Is the gentleman one of Bonnet's customers, do you think?"
"I do," Jamie had said, watching the boat pull to the shore. "Take us a bit to the north, if you please, Mr. Rock. We'll go ashore."
The three of them had landed half a mile from the beach and worked their way down through the wood, then took up their positions in the shrubbery and settled down to wait. The sun was hot, but so close to the shore there was a fresh breeze, and it wasn't uncomfortable in the shade, bar the insects. For the hundredth time, Roger brushed away something crawling on his neck.
The waiting was making him jumpy. His skin itched with salt, and the scent of the tidal forest, with its peculiar mix of aromatic pine and distant seaweed, the crunch of shell and needle beneath his feet, brought back to him in vivid detail the day he had killed Lillington. He had gone then, as now, with the intent of killing Stephen Bonnet, but the elusive pirate had been warned and an ambush laid. It had been by the will of God and the skill of Jamie Fraser that he hadn't left his own carcass in a similar forest, bones scattered by wild pigs, bleaching among the gleam of dry needles and the white of empty shells. His throat was tight again, but he couldn't shout or sing to loosen it. He should pray, he thought, but couldn't. Even the constant litany that had echoed through his heart since the night he had learned she was gone, Lord, that she might be safe. Even that small petition had somehow dried up. His present thought, Lord, that I might kill him. He couldn't voice that, even to himself. The deliberate intent and desire to murder, surely he couldn't expect such a prayer to be heard. For a moment he envied Jamie and Ian their faith in gods of wrath and vengeance. While Rourke and Moses had brought the fishing boat in, he had heard Jamie murmur to Claire and take her hands in his, and heard her then bless him in the Gaelic with the invocation to Michael of the Red Domain, the blessing of a warrior on his way to battle. Ian had merely sat cross-legged and silent, watching the shore draw nearer, his face remote. If he prayed, there was no telling to whom. When they landed, though, he had paused on the bank of one of the myriad inlets, and scooping up mud in his fingers, had carefully painted his face, drawing a line from forehead to chin, then four parallel streaks across his left cheek, a thick dark circle around his right eye. It was remarkably unsettling. Quite obviously, neither of them had the slightest qualms about the business, nor the least hesitation in asking God to aid their efforts. He envied them, and sat in stubborn silence, the gates of heaven closed against him, his hand on the hilt of his knife, and a loaded pistol in his belt, planning murder. A little past noon, the burly captain of the slaver came back, footsteps crunching indifferently on the layer of dried pine needles. They let him pass, waiting. Late in the afternoon, it began to rain. She had dozed off again from sheer boredom. It began to rain. The sound roused her briefly, then drove her more deeply into slumber, drops pattering softly on the palmetto thatch above. She woke abruptly when one of the drops fell cold on her face, followed quickly by a few of its fellows. She jerked upright, blinking with momentary disorientation. She rubbed a hand over her face and looked up. There was a small wet patch on the plaster ceiling, surrounded by a much larger stain from previous leaks, and drops were forming in its centre like magic, each perfect bead falling one after another after another, to splat on the mattress ticking. She got up to push the bed out from under the leak, and then stopped. Slowly she straightened up and put up a hand to the wet patch. The ceiling was a normal one for the time, less than 7 feet. She could reach it easily. "She damn tall," she said aloud. "Damn right she is." She put her hand flat on the wet patch and pushed as hard as she could. The wet plaster gave way at once, and so did the rotten laths behind it. She jerked back her hand, scratching her arm on the jagged edges of lath, and a small cascade of dirty water, centipedes, mouse droppings, and fragments of palmetto leaf poured in through the hole she'd made. She wiped her hand on her shift, reached up, seized the edge of the hole, and pulled, ripping down chunks of lath and plaster, until she'd made a hole that would accommodate her head and shoulders. "Okay," she whispered to the baby, or herself. She glanced around the room, put on her stays over her shift, then tucked the sharpened busk down the front.
Then, standing on the bed, she took a deep breath, shoved her steepled hands upward as though about to dive, and grabbed for anything solid enough to provide leverage. Little by little, she hauled herself, sweating and grunting, up into the steaming thatch of sharp-edged leaves, teeth gritted and eyes closed against the dirt and dead insects. Her head thrust into moist open air and she gasped for breath. She had an elbow hooked over a beam, and using that for leverage, pulled farther up. Her legs kicked vainly in empty air, trying to propel her upward, and she felt the wrench of shoulder muscles, but sheer desperation propelled her upward. That, and the nightmare vision of Emmanuel coming into the room and seeing the bottom half of her hanging out of the ceiling. With a rending shower of leaves, she hauled herself out to lie flat on the rain-wet thatch of the roof. The rain was still coming down heavily, and she was soaked in moments. A little way away, she saw some sort of structure sticking up amid the palmetto leaves of the thatch, and wriggled her way cautiously toward it, constantly fearful lest the roof give way beneath her weight, probing with hands and elbows for the firmness of the roof beams below the thatched leaves. The structure proved to be a small platform, firmly set on the beams, with a railing on one side. She scrambled onto this and crouched, panting. It was still raining on shore, but out to sea the sky was mostly clear, and the setting sun behind her spilled a burnt, bloody orange over sky and water through black streaks of shattered cloud. It looked like the end of the world, she thought, her ribs heaving against the lacing of her stays. From the vantage point of the roof, she could see over the scrub forest. The slice of beach she had glimpsed from her window was clearly visible. And beyond it, two ships lying close offshore. Two boats were pulled up on shore, though, well separated from each other. Probably one from each ship, she thought. One of the ships must be the slaver, the other likely Howard's. A wave of humiliated rage ran over her. She was surprised that the rain didn't steam off her skin. There was no time to dwell on that, though. Voices came faintly through the patter of rain, and she ducked down, then realized that no one was likely to look up and see her. Raising her head to peer through the railing, she saw figures come out of the trees onto the beach, a single file of chained men with two or three guards. Josh! She strained her eyes to see, but in the eerie twilight the figures were no more than silhouettes. She thought she made out the tall, slender figures of the two Fulani men. Perhaps the shorter one behind them was Josh, but she couldn't tell. Her fingers curled tight around the railing, impotent. She couldn't help, she knew it, but to be obliged simply to watch. As she watched, a thin scream came from the beach and a smaller figure ran out of the wood, skirts flying. The guards turned, startled. One of them seized Fedre. It had to be her. Brianna could hear her screaming, "Josh! Josh!" The sound of it harsh as the cry of a distant gull. She was struggling with the guard. Some of the chained men turned abruptly, lunging at the other. A struggling knot of men fell to the sand. Someone was running toward them from the boat, something in his hand. The vibration in her feet jerked her attention from the scene on the beach. "Crap," she said involuntarily. Emmanuel's head poked up over the edge of the roof, staring in disbelief. Then his face contorted, and he heaved himself up. There must be a ladder attached to the side of the house, she thought. Well, of course there would be. You wouldn't have a lookout platform and no way to get up to it. While her mind was busying itself with that nonsense, her body was taking more concrete steps. She had drawn the sharpened busk and was crouched against the platform, hand low, as Ian had taught her. Emmanuel made a derisive face at the thing in her hand and grabbed at her. They could hear the gentleman coming well before they saw him. He was singing softly to himself, a French air of some kind. He was alone. The servant must have gone back to the ship while they were making their way through the woods. Roger got softly to his feet, crouched behind his chosen bush. His limbs were stiff, and he stretched inconspicuously. As the gentleman drew even with him, Jamie stepped out into the path in front of him. The man, a small, foppish-looking sort, uttered a girlish shriek of alarm. Before he could flee, though, Jamie had stepped forward and grasped his arm, smiling pleasantly.
"Your servant, sir," he said courteously. "Have you been calling upon Mr. Bonnet, by chance?"
The man blinked at him, confused.
"Bonnet? Why, yes."
Roger felt a tightness in his chest ease suddenly. Thank God, they'd found the right place.
"Who are you, sir?"
the small man was demanding, trying to draw his forearm out of Jamie's grip to no avail. There was no need to keep hidden now. Roger and Ian stepped out of the bushes, and the gentleman gasped at sight of Ian in his war paint, then glanced wildly back and forth between Jamie and Roger. Evidently settling on Roger as the most civilized-looking person present, the gentleman appealed to him.
"I beg you, sir, who are you and what do you want?"
"We are in search of an abducted young woman," Roger said. "A very tall young woman with red hair. Have you..."
Before he could finish, he saw the man's eyes dilate with panic. Jamie saw it too, and twisted the man's wrist, sending him to his knees, mouth awry with pain.
"I think, sir," Jamie said with impeccable courtesy, holding tight, "we must oblige you to tell us what you know."
She couldn't let him get hold of her. That was her only conscious thought. He grabbed at her weaponless arm, and she yanked free, skin slippery with rain, and struck at him in the same motion. The point of the busk skidded up his arm, leaving a reddening furrow, but he ignored this and lunged at her. She fell backward over the railing, landing awkwardly on her hands and knees in the leaves, but he hadn't got her. He'd fallen on his own knees on the platform with a thud that shook the whole roof. She scrabbled madly to the edge of the roof, hands and knees poking randomly through the thatch, and threw her legs over the edge into space, kicking frantically for the rungs of the ladder. He was after her, had her wrist in a grip like an eel's bite, was hauling her back onto the roof. She drew back her free hand and lashed him hard across the face with the busk. He roared, and his grip loosened. She wrenched free and dropped. She hit the sand flat on her back with a bone-shaking thump, and lay paralyzed, unable to breathe, the rain pelting down on her face. A hoot of triumph came from the roof, and then a growl of exasperated dismay. He thought he'd killed her.
"Great," she thought muzzily. "Keep thinking that."
The shock of impact was beginning to wear off. Her diaphragm lurched into motion, and glorious air rushed into her lungs. Could she move? She didn't know, and didn't dare to try. Through rain-clotted lashes, she saw Emmanuel's bulk ease over the edge of the roof, foot groping for the crude ladder rungs she could now see, nailed to the wall. She'd lost the busk when she fell, but saw it gleaming dully a foot from her head. With Emmanuel's back momentarily turned, she whipped her hand up and grabbed it, then lay still, playing possum. They had nearly reached the house when sounds from the nearby forest stopped them. Roger froze, then ducked off the path. Jamie and Ian had already melted into the wood. The sounds weren't coming from the path, though, but from somewhere off to the left. Voices, men's voices shouting orders, and the shuffling of feet, the clink of chains. A thrill of panic shot through him. Were they taking her away? He was already soaked with rain, but felt the bloom of cold sweat over his body, colder than the rain. Howard, the man they'd apprehended in the wood, had assured them Brianna was safe in the house, but what would he know? He listened, straining his ears for the sound of a woman's voice, and heard it, a high, thin scream. He jerked toward it, only to find Jamie beside him, gripping his arm.
"That's not Brianna," his father-in-law said urgently. "Ian will go. You and I. For the house."
There was no time for argument. The sounds of violence on the beach came faintly, shouts and cries. But Jamie was right. That voice wasn't Brianna's. Ian was running toward the beach, making no effort now to be silent. An instant's hesitation, instinct urging him to go after Ian. Then Roger was on the path, following Jamie toward the house at the run. Emmanuel bent over her. She felt his bulk and lunge upward like a striking snake, sharp and busk like a fang. She'd aim for his head, hoping for eye or throat, but counting at least on his jerking reflexively back, putting him at a disadvantage. He jerked all right, up and away, but was much faster than she'd thought. She struck with all her force, and the sharpened busk drove under his arm with a rubbery shock. He froze for a moment, mouth open in incredulity, looking at the ivory rod that stuck out of his armpit. Then he wrenched it out and lunged for her with an outraged bellow. She was already on her feet, though, and running for the woods. From somewhere ahead, she heard more yelling and a blood-curdling scream. Another, and then more, these coming from the front of the house. Dazed and terrified, she kept running, her mind only slowly grasping that some of the screams had words.
Castle Doone!
Duh, she thought, in absolute astonishment, then tripped over a branch on the ground and fell arse over tea kettle, landing in a dishevelled heap. She struggled to her feet, thinking absurdly, this can't be good for the baby, and groped for another weapon. Her fingers were trembling, wouldn't work. She scrabbled the ground vainly. Then Emmanuel popped up beside her like the demon king, grabbing her arm with a gloating, ah! The shock made her sway, her vision going grey at the edges. She could still hear blood-curdling screams on the distant beach, but no more yelling at the house. Emmanuel was saying something full of satisfaction and threat, but she wasn't listening. There seemed to be something wrong with his face. It went in and out of focus, and she blinked hard, shaking her head to clear her sight. It wasn't her eyes, though. It was him. His face melted slowly from bare-toothed menace to a look of faint astonishment. He frowned, lips pursing, so she saw the pink lining of his mouth, and blinked two or three times. Then he made a small, choked noise, put a hand to his chest, and dropped to his knees, still gripping her arm. He fell over, and she landed on top of him. She pulled away. His fingers came away easily, all their strength suddenly gone, and stumbled to her feet, panting and shaking. Emmanuel was lying on his back, legs bent under him at what would have been an excruciating angle, had he been alive. She gulped for air, trembling, afraid to believe it. But he was dead. There was no mistaking the look of it. Her breath was coming better now, and she began to be conscious of the cuts and bruises on her bare feet. She still felt stunned, unable to decide what to do next. The decision was made for her in the next instant, as Stephen Bonnet came dashing toward her through the wood. She jerked to instant alertness and spun on her heel to flee. She made it no more than 6 paces before he had an arm about her throat, dragging her off her feet. "Hush now, darling," he said in her ear, sounding breathless. He was hot, and his stubble rasped her cheek. "I mean you no harm. I'll leave you safe on the shore. But you're the only thing I've got right now. We'll keep your men from killing me." He ignored the body of Emmanuel entirely. The heavy forearm left her throat, and he grabbed her arm, trying to drag her in the direction away from the beach. Evidently, he meant to make for the hidden inlet on the opposite side of the island where they had landed the day before. "Move, darling, now." "Let go!" She dug her feet in hard, yanking on her trapped arm. "I'm not going anywhere with you. Help!" she shrieked, as loudly as she could. "Help! Roger!" He looked startled and raised his free arm to wipe the streaming rain out of his eyes. There was something in his hand. The last of the light gleamed orange on glass.
Holy Lord, he'd brought his testicle. Bree! Brianna! Where are you?
Roger's voice frantic, and a shot of adrenaline shot through her at the sound, giving her the strength to jerk her arm from Bonnet's grasp.
Here! Here I am, Roger! She shouted at the top of her voice.
Bonnet glanced over his shoulder. The bushes were shaking, two men at least coming through them. He wasted no time, but darted into the forest, bending low to avoid a branch, and was gone. In the next instant, Roger crashed out of the brush and seized her, crushing her against him.
You're all right. Has he hurt you?
He dropped his knife and held her by the arms, eyes trying to look everywhere at once, her face, her body, into her eyes.
I'm fine, she said, feeling